From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. We've started another culinary war. Last time, the battle was over whether cornbread should be sweet or savory. Now another baked good enters the fray, the Southern biscuit.
The other day, I ate a ricochet biscuit. Well, it's the kind of a biscuit that's supposed to bounce off the wall back in your mouth. If it don't bounce back, you go hungry.
So how do you like your biscuits, and who serves the best biscuit in the state? We have plenty of recommendations for you, and it looks like some of you are already hungry for this conversation. Here are your first thoughts. Jason Ganesh tweets, they have the right combo of fluffy inside, flaky crumb, and crispy outside. Buttery but not greasy, good with gravy or a chicken fillet. We should also recognize that what makes a good sandwich may not be a good biscuit for sopping up runny eggs or pot liquor. Jason says, Mama Jewel's Kitchen in Athens is a restaurant that gets biscuits right. And Amanda Respes tweets that she gets her biscuit fix from the Flying Biscuit Cafe in Candler Park with cranberry apple butter and a big ol' mimosa. Hashtag you bet your biscuits. We always love to know what you think, whether it's about biscuits or not. Call us at 404-500-9457 and find us on Twitter at OST Talk or post to Facebook, and we might feature your comments on the show. Well, Marvel Comics dropped a bombshell about one of its most popular characters yesterday. Turns out Captain America all along has been a member of Hydra, a terrorist organization in the Marvel Universe. A lot of the fans were excited about that plot twist. Other people were pretty devastated and angry. GPB's own social media manager, Rosemary Jean-Louis, says she fainted when she heard. The passionate reaction to the news shows the close connection that fans feel to comic book characters that they've possibly grown up with, that they've been reading about and living with for years. This weekend, that connection will be celebrated. The 10th annual MomoCon Comic Convention returns to Atlanta, and one of the event's featured speakers is my guest today. Atlanta comic book artist Dexter Vines. He's worked with nearly every major comic book publisher and joins me online this morning. Hi, Dexter.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Look, I'm not blaming you for the whole Captain America thing. I know you're not involved, but these plot twists come out every once in a while where they you know what I mean? Where they write up into the story something that seems completely antithetical to what we've known about that character for so long. Why is that? Why does that happen?
That's just kind of how comics is. Comics are kind of like soap operas, you know, like that. And you'll have this, you know, kind of jaw-dropping, earth-shattering kind of event, you know, because I heard about this late, actually. So I kind of missed the whole big announcement of it. But I'm pretty sure the fanboys will definitely be putting their opinion out there and letting Marvel know whether they like it or hate it, you know.
And the fangirls, Dexter.
Definitely.
Don't forget the fangirls.
Definitely.
So you are going to write a Han Solo comic. So let's take a listen. If people have forgotten who Han Solo is, here's a scene from Star Wars: A New Hope. This is where we first meet Solo in that movie, and you also hear the voice of Jedi Master Obi-Wan Kenobi.
Han Solo, I'm Captain of the Millennium Falcon. Chewie here tells me you're looking for passage to the Alderaan system.
Yes, indeed. If it's a fast ship.
Fast ship? You've never heard of the Millennium Falcon?
Should I have?
It's a ship that made the Kessel Run in less than 12 parsecs.
So how much, when you're writing a Han Solo comic, how much latitude do you get? Can you drop a bombshell like they just did?
No. Well, actually, I'm not writing, man. I'm the inker on Han Solo. But no, everything goes through Lucas. That's a whole nother... another beast there where most
of your comics... Oh, because it's a Lucas property.
Right, right. So everything from my understanding, everything from the movies to the comics, they're all in continuity, whereas Marvel or DC, you know, their movies have one continuity and the comics will have another continuity. But with Star Wars, it's all one thing. So, you know, you can't interject anything new. So it's up to the Lucas heads now to let you know what you can and can't do.
How much do you hear from fans? Do they find you and follow you and complain when they don't like something?
No, fans generally like stuff like that. Fans won't complain to the artist. They're all about, you know, hitting the company up because they know, you know, that's the company and editors are, you know, making those kind of decisions. So no, we won't get that kind of thing. So thankfully.
Well, that's nice. I mean, right?
So,
I mean,
but yeah, fans are definitely outspoken in this industry. I'm pretty sure you know.
Yes.
You know, if fans hate something, they're going to let you know, you know.
Yes. Well, you're about to go into the thick of it if you go to a MomoCon, so good luck
definitely,
with that.
Definitely.
Let's hear from Cristela Rosa. She's a comic book fan, and she spoke with NPR's Latino USA during a comic book convention in New York City. And she's talking about the lack of diversity in the comic book universes. Take a listen.
So, like, growing up with comics, like, I love comics, but I saw so little of myself. I was always liking more of the male characters, too, for that reason. And then I remember, I kept getting back on and off again with the wagon reading comics, and the first time I ever saw the second Batgirl and her whole entire face is covered, I'm like, wow, wouldn't it be great if that character were like actually Asian underneath?
So is that getting better, what Cristela is talking about? She grew up with very little diversity. Is that improving?
Yeah, I think it is definitely improving. I mean, it definitely has a ways to go, but I definitely think there are definitely more diversity in comics. And it's just, you know, I think that's just kind of how, you know, it's going, and it's just more diversity, period. So hopefully that will continue until it's not a thing where we're asking that question. But I think as long as we're asking it, we definitely need it.
What do you mean it's not a thing where we're asking that question? What does that mean?
Well, I mean, as far as is there diversity in comics? So I think once there is diversity or true diversity, you won't feel the need.
Oh, we won't even hear that question anymore.
Right, right.
And you won't have to answer it anymore.
Exactly, exactly.
Well, then let's hear a little bit from Brian Stelfreeze, because I understand he's number one. He's a veteran. He's been in the business a long time, but he's the one that really got you into comic books, right?
Yeah, definitely. I first met Brian at a comic book convention, the old Atlanta Fantasy Fair, before it became DragonCon. And, of course, being a little black kid and seeing, you know, somebody of color behind the table and drawing, it really kind of opened my eyes and let me know, all right, I can do this, you know. And it definitely lit a spark in me. And, I sat there probably for an hour and talked to Brian. And he really, you know, I left that show with just a new fire and drive, you know, to get into comics.
So he is based in Atlanta, as you mentioned, and he gave an interview to a Publisher Weekly for their podcast More to Come. And here he's talking about how the comic book industry is changing.
There are no comic books anymore. There are companies. Every company is doing one, and, you know, the entire company is dedicated to one story. And I'm not personally a fan of that. It's like I liked Spider-Man when Spider-Man was Spider-Man and the Hulk was the Hulk, and they didn't cross over that much.
What is he talking about here? I mean, first of all, is he only talking about the major comic book publishers like Marvel or DC, or is he including the whole industry in that?
I'm not sure, but I would just say, yeah, as far as Marvel and DC, yeah, everything is like intertwined now in the comic book universes. And whether that's on purpose or not, I think that's just kind of how things have evolved. You know, where I think, yeah, back in the day, everybody, you know, the companies just looked at, yeah, Spider-Man and is his own thing, and Hulk is his own thing, and Fantastic Four is his own thing. But now I think they just, and, you know, this is our world, you know, it's all one big world. So I think it's just that, I think it just kind of evolved that way. I don't think it just kind of, you know, I don't think it was like engineered, and I think it just kind of evolved over the years to that.
Although, I mean, if you're just joining us, my guest is Atlanta comic book artist Dexter Vines. He's one of the featured speakers at this weekend's MomoCon. And just a little pushback, Dexter, because I've always imagined the reason they did that, started having characters appear in other comics, was to sell more comics. If you're a Spider-Man fan, then instead of just buying the Spider-Man comics, if he appears in Fantastic Four, then you might be more likely to go and buy the Fantastic Four.
True.
You know, buy that?
True. So, yeah, I mean, I definitely can see that. But like I said, I don't think that was, at least it didn't feel like that. It didn't feel like that was like we're going to do that too. And I think you introduce those kind of things and, you know, realize, hey, people like that, you know, and it just kind of develops from there.
Well, then let's hear one more comment from your, I guess, mentor, Atlantic comic book artist Brian Stelfreeze. This is, again, from that same 2004 interview that he did with the podcast More to Come. And they asked him what advice he'd give to young, aspiring comic book artists.
The best advice that I could give to someone who's interested in becoming a comic book artist is to try not to become a comic book artist, but to try to become a comic book storyteller. There's a huge difference between being an artist and a storyteller. And I think the people that are really doing well in comics now are the people who use their art as a vehicle to tell stories.
What is the difference, Dexter, between in your mind, between an artist and a storyteller?
Well, an artist is, I guess, it's kind of really general. You know, an artist is just somebody who you can paint a picture and you're an artist. Whereas a storyteller is you're literally telling a story with your pictures. So I tell people, like, they'll come up to me and show me their portfolio and, you know, you have to have, you know, your anatomy and perspective, and then you have to, you know, put this all in to one thing and tell a story without even, without words being there. You know, people need to be able to tell what's going on just specifically looking at your artwork, going from panel to panel. It needs to read even without the word balloons. So that's the aspect of storytelling. So,
can you develop that, or is that a skill you either are born with or not?
No, you can definitely develop that, you know, and I tell people there, you know, I tell, you know, guys when they are, and gals when they come up to me and ask me for advice, I tell them also, look at a movie and then turn the sound down and just look and see what happens. And you can kind of, you know, that helps you kind of tell a good director from a bad director, you know, also. So it works in, you know, in the film media also. So like I say, it's just all about, you know, telling that story with just your pictures.
So you're about to meet with a whole bunch of fans, and I wonder what your thought is. In a couple surveys, Atlanta was named the number one nerdiest city in America. I wonder if you agree with that. You saw that, I
would not know, but there are plenty of us out here. I include myself into the media geekdom. I'm definitely, you know, just as big a fan as the fans. You know, I'm a big Walking Dead geek, you know. Game of Thrones, you know, you name it, you know, I'm there. So
No spoilers, Dexter.
no spoilers, for sure.
Well, my guest has been Atlanta comic book artist Dexter Vines. You can catch him at MomoCon this weekend in Atlanta. Dexter, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
This is On Second Thought. Chef Hugh Atchison is considered to be one of the country's top culinary minds, especially here in Georgia. He owns 4 restaurants around the state. He's written a slew of best-selling cookbooks. And, of course, there's his role as a judge on the hit show Top Chef.
I realize maybe they didn't fully integrate the flavor of the rose petal jelly into it. If you get too much, it feels like you're eating somebody's grandmother. It's like just, I mean, it's like perfumed.
But Hugh Atchison has another life off camera. He's also invested in education, and he's created a new home economics curriculum for middle school students in Georgia that might help improve their culinary literacy. It's always great to have you, Hugh. Welcome back.
Well, it's good to be here, Celeste. Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you. And I wonder if you'd start by telling me what culinary literacy is.
You know, I think that we lost some traction in the food world somehow in the last 60 years. We adopted convenience and we forgot how to cook. So to me, sort of culinary literacy is just understanding the basics of food, understanding how to cook food from scratch again in the most simple way possible. It's poaching an egg and making a vinaigrette and having that sort of understanding of food that makes it real, that there's a connection to it, and that we're going to raise kids who can say, I got this.
So you're not talking about knowing what a truffle is? Or
I don't need more chefs in the world, Celeste. Honestly, we don't. I mean, a couple more in my kitchens would be good now and again because, you know, it's hard to find good people. But no, I just want to raise a generation that understands food more than the previous generation does and did.
I mean, the fact that you're creating this curriculum implies that you think this is a need that's not being fulfilled in the school system now.
You know, I put it this way. We have family and consumer sciences, which is the modern term for home ec, in most public schools in Georgia. A lot of it's been canceled, and a lot of they've been getting away from it a little bit. And the curriculum that there is sometimes taught by thoroughly nuanced teachers who are really invested in it and really bring a lot to it. But the core curriculum is really dated. And so what I want to do is I just want to make it much more contemporary so it's a nuanced, interesting curriculum taught by nuanced, interesting, amazingly empowered teachers. And that combination, I think, is much more powerful than we've got now.
One of the things that kind of sparked this, I understand, was because your daughter took the class and they were teaching her.
Not very good stuff. I mean, just basic stuff. A lot of sort of Rice Krispie treats and how to make red velvet cupcakes and things like that. And we all love those things. They're treats in this world.
But they were teaching them to make red velvet cupcakes from a Betty Crocker mix.
Right. They're pretty instant. And then making instant croissants out of a tube and wrapping them in bacon and baking them in the oven. And that's not to say that there aren't sort of some skill sets that you can learn from that stuff. But what about if I can teach retainable knowledge to a kid? And this is all kids, regardless of color, creed, class, economic scale, where they live. This is all in the state of Georgia. This can happen, that we have all these kids learning how to poach an egg or make a vinaigrette or make a super roasted chicken or learning how to read a cell phone contract or learning about a lease because they're going to sign one eventually. And a lot of these kids just are going into this and they're just going into it blind. We're just not equipping them. To me, it's like merit badges. I want to give these kids merit badges for the future and empower them to feel like they can really tackle these problems of life.
So help me understand how this works, because it seemed to me, but for a lot of schools, that many of them got rid of home ec classes quite some time ago, which means they probably also got rid of those classroom kitchens. So if you're making something from scratch, you need more than an oven. I mean, you need to teach knife skills.
You do. I mean, we'll be live for grade 6 in Athens, Clark County, and 4 middle schools next year. Now, they have home ec classrooms still in all of those schools. They have amazing programs of ag science and things like this, so we're utilizing a lot of those things. So these classrooms still exist in a lot of places. So we're trying to do it in a very budget-minded way. We're going into, hopefully, the existing slot of Hamley Consumer Sciences and just revamping the curriculum that's there. We're giving them new skill sets and new sort of topics to cover that are really nuanced and accompanied by great videos produced at Google and really good step-by-step knife work and step-by-step how to do this recipe. And this is core stuff. But imagine if all these kids in 8 years can be 19, 20 years old and know how to make a great salad and cook farro and rice and roasted chicken. Then we change the whole paradigm of how these kids are living. I mean, we know that good food creates better humans, right? We know that. But we're
in a lot of different ways, not just physiologically.
Different ways. And it's empowering to be able to feed yourself and your family. And we're just not teaching these kids those core skills. So that's what this is about. But it's not just about food. It's about sort of DIY and life hacks. It's about fixing things before replacing them. It's about how to read that cell phone contract and why you don't lease a car when it's your first automobile, or how to sign a lease for the first time, or just the really basic ideas. It's auto renewals and subscriptions that we all look at our bank statements these days and we're like, wow, why did they charge me again for that? I thought I canceled it a year ago. And it's because you clicked the little auto renewal thing. And we just don't understand like the gravitas of what this all means in our daily routine. And I think we just need to get to the bottom of it and equip these kids with skills that really matter.
So this kind of came up in my own home recently because my son had a friend over and he told his friend, my mom's making bread. And he's like, wow, how do you do that? And my son's like, flour, water, and some yeast.
Yeah.
I'm like, what? You know, and the kid was blown away that that's all that was in bread.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, didn't understand the science of how flour, water, and a little yeast became a loaf of bread. I mean, that's a great moment for me to tell, but how does that then translate into more self-sufficient human being if I'm teaching that?
Because to get over what I call the age of convenience, the last 80 years of us buying into the ease of buying things made for us, fast food, you know, shelves and shelves of pre-prepared food items, to get away from that and to live in a healthy world again, we have to understand the basic crux of food, that when we mix this with this, we create this from scratch. We have to reintroduce the idea of value into food in the way that I can actually produce a great meal for four for $10, which you'd be hard-pressed to go to McDonald's and buy enough food for a family of four for $10 these days. So this is we're trying to rip the sort of facade that food is fancy, food is difficult, food is something you shouldn't be able to try at home anymore. And we just need to make sure people understand that we can all do this. It's really, really straightforward. So, but that's like bread. I mean, people just do not understand the basic tenets of food anymore. So we're just trying to reintroduce that into their lives.
So does this translate into another area? I know your guys are starting in Athens, but you're looking ahead to a year or two and turning it into a national program. Do you have to make changes when you leave Athens, Georgia, and take it to, say, Iowa or Seattle?
No, I think the good thing about the current state of food policy and the current state of education in the United States is we're all on a similar playing field. We all need to work on these things. And I think that we're creating a curriculum that's not geographically specific. Seasons change, little things change here and there, but I think there's still a core context from Portland, Oregon to Portland, Maine to Miami, Florida to, you know, southern Arizona that is, you know, how do you poach an egg? You know, we need to learn that regardless. That's not regionally specific, and how to make a vinaigrette is not regionally specific, but these are both things that take 3 or 4 minutes, and they're really core cooking ideas, and if they usurp that idea of going to the fast food drive-in for dinner, then we've won, and we need to win over and over and over again, because we need to create the next generation who feels totally empowered, like they got this. And cooking is that thing. It's like people who cook on a regular basis, they just got this.
I wonder how that, in terms of teaching and engaging students, one of the things I found interesting was that in the plan for the digital and online curriculum is you're going to bring in people like Jacques Pepin and have him teach how to poach an egg. What's the value in that? I mean, your average 15-year-old doesn't know who he is, right? So where do you get benefit from the celebrities coming in to teach these basic techniques?
I think you want retainable stuff. And the way you get retainable stuff is you have this crazy guy who's deep French accent, but he's ebullient and awesome and brilliant and will teach somebody in a way that hopefully they'll really remember. And we still have those little iterances of times in our back to our elementary school days and our middle school days where somebody taught us something and it still sticks with us. So we're just trying to make sure that every lesson in this is really tied to that notion, that we can really grasp at it and really remember it. Because I don't remember algebra, but I would remember Jacques Pepin teaching me how to poach an egg. I don't remember trig all that well, but I would remember Tom Colicchio teaching me how to make a really simple salad. So these are the ideas and hopefully the connections I've got to make this just a little more well-rounded and really an approachable and retainable sort of way of learning.
Who did that for you? When you think back to the very basics of food, what are the lessons that stick in your head that you actually do remember?
You know, I started working at such a young age that it was more in restaurants. We're starting when I was 14, and that helped me a lot later on. You know, I was a much better human, not just because I knew how to cook professionally, but just because I knew how to cook. So when I went off to university, I'd never finished, but I was a hit definitely because people would come over and we would make dinner and it would be really economical and really smart. But we were living in Montreal and having a good life, and everybody would sort of pitch in $2, $3, and we make a big supper. And we just need those type of basic skill sets. So, I mean, there's so many ways that we learn, but this is just one way of making sure it's really retainable.
Do you think that part of, say, for example, the obesity crisis in mm-hmm. the United States is connected to this disconnection with our food and food preparation?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, it's very documented that when you have Dunkin' Donuts for breakfast and McDonald's for lunch and Kentucky Fried Chicken for dinner, your chances of having a really successful time in school and paying attention and having a good, well-rounded life of good health, your chances are slim. So we need to make sure that we're raising a generation that can feed themselves and feed themselves with skill sets and really go back to the times, you know, I'm not looking for that time way past 100 years ago when everybody made food from scratch and we all had little gardens and occasionally we killed a chicken in the yard. I mean, we're modern. This is very contemporary, but it's really important to be able to make an omelet and it's really important to be able to make soup at home because sometimes you just need to. And I think that disconnect has caused, and the convenience items that we eat every day, and that just the ready-made food has really contributed to those type 2 diabetes and obesity rates and just sort of a non-learning society when it comes to core skills.
And one of the things that you have referred to is that in our effort to focus on the STEM education, science and technology and mathematics, that perhaps we've left behind what we think of home ec or the domestic sciences because we don't think of them as advanced. Can you both train somebody to be not a chef, but a good passable cook to be able to make their bread if they're out of bread and be an advanced technologist?
You know, we hope to create better citizens through this. And I think that better citizens understand food. And when you understand food, you understand ratios and you understand percentages and you understand that a great vinaigrette is 3 parts oil and 1 part acid. And then when you're out in a garden at a school, because they all have gardens now, you can understand that this seed is producing this amount of food and this is doing this. And then photosynthesis occurs and all these things. And this is when we harvest. And this is why we're harvesting. This is what happens when we poach an egg and protein coagulation. I mean, there's just so much that you can bring into it to satisfy STEM and STEAM attributes of learning and education these days that are so much more rewarding and really can impact later testing and things like that.
Yeah, that's why a lot of people don't bake because it's such a precise science.
Right, and it
is. The chemistry is so precise.
But that's the beauty of it, and that's the beauty that we need to teach to people is that science and math, though I don't remember a lot of the math I learned at school, I do this every day because we're following recipes and we're writing recipes and we're writing ratios and we're figuring out complex theories and complex ideas of food. What I want to do is get back to this time of saying, you know, I mean, we also used to say things like, you know, I used to make jam with my grandmother. But we never say I made jam with my mother because mom bought us Smuckers. And we just need to realize that there's a world there that's beautiful in making food from scratch. So if I cook at home tonight, later on, or tomorrow, my kids are around the house and they're seeing me cook and they engage with me and they help me out. But they're learning through that too. But then we sit down and we have dinner. And that's what the average American household isn't doing right now, is they're not gathering around the table. And I also say this a lot. You're never going to have a beautiful family moment over a bunch of pizza pockets. You have a beautiful family moment over a home-cooked meal that means something to you, that was bought and purchased by farmers you know, that had skill sets going into it. And it can be simple. It could be a roasted chicken and some rice and a beautiful salad and some roasted broccoli. But if you made that from scratch and your kids saw you do it, you've just taught them something. That's equipping them with life skills. And that's more important than any pizza pocket can ever be. So it's just a moment, and it's cool, and we need more of those moments.
Do your kids bring their own lunches to school?
You know, Beatrice, who's now 13, I remember this scampering around the kitchen when she was 5 years old, and it was the first day of school, and she was going off to kindergarten at Chase Street Elementary right around the corner from our house. And she was making a salad, and she was making a vinaigrette from scratch in a mason jar because she knew how to do it at five. And she was packing it separately to dress later. And to me, you know, very proud chef father, I was weepy. But she had learned something, and she had learned something that she will never forget. Bea's a special kid, super smart and raised in a very culinary household, but this could be any kid. And life's just better when you know those skills and when you've got it.
Chef Hugh Atchison, he's the founder of Seed Life Skills. It's an organization with plans to change the way schools teach home economics. Thank you so much.
Well, thanks for having me.
This is On Second Thought. One of Shakespeare's most famous works has attracted the creative attention of a unique theater troupe here in Atlanta.
By fire and by water, between the earth and sky, we stand like the world tree rooted deep, ground high.
The Fern Theater will stage King Lear this weekend, but it has a twist. The production features women in roles that were written for men. That's a reversal that actress Jennifer Acker is pretty proud of. She plays two male characters in Fern's production, and she's my guest this morning. Thanks for joining us, Jennifer.
Good morning, Celeste.
What roles do you play?
I play Edmund and Oswald.
Okay, we're going to talk a little bit about that in a moment, but let's also welcome Tim McDonough. He's chair of the Theater Studies Program at Emory University. Hi, Tim.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well, thanks. And you cast an all-male production, correct?
That's right, which is the original practice of Shakespeare.
And, right. But that was because it was unseemly for women to get on stage. Wasn't that the original reason?
That was the original reason, yes. It was considered an immoral profession for women to appear on stage. And so young males, probably teenage boys, played female roles.
And Jennifer, I doubt you would think of yourself as being immoral or unseemly.
Well, depends on the day.
So I want to play first a comment about, I guess, the most obvious reason or clear reason why one might want to do this. This is Jessica Fern Hunt. She's co-creative director of the Fern Theater.
There just aren't a lot of roles for women in Shakespeare. Every Shakespeare play has between 2 and 4 women. And Atlanta has so many wonderfully talented classical actors, female actors. And I wanted to explore the Shakespearean text with all female voices.
So that's clear. It gives women more chances to play. What other reasons do you think, Jennifer, there are, or what do you take away from it that's more than just having a role?
There's a hunger, I think, that does certainly come from roles that we are not typically allowed to play on stage or represent on stage. But there's a hunger of getting the opportunity to do this work. And so what comes to the table is a group of females who are all in all the time. And so the product, I believe, is really strong because we are so desperately creating with each other. And then another interesting sort of side effect that I didn't anticipate is the way the rehearsal room feels with all females. There is a kind of common understanding and a sensitivity almost that I haven't gotten in other processes that are more co-ed. It sort of harkens to Women by the Fire to me.
So, Tim, what do you take away, or what benefit is there, or deeper meaning maybe, when someone plays a role that's a gender that they were not born to? If you, in your case, cast a man to play a woman's role, or in Jennifer's case, you're a female playing a male's role, what difference does that make?
Well, in the modern age, it's just as liberating for a male to play a female role as it is the reverse. It's an opportunity to explore another perspective, another gender. We at Emory had done 2 productions of As You Like It in repertory, one all male, one all female. And what we discovered was that the basic differences were differences generated by person rather than gender. It's what different people bring to the role. There are gender-influenced kinds of choices, and it's really important to see women doing powerful speeches, women making decisions from a position of authority.
Let's hear a comment. This is from one of the audience members at the Fern Theater's all-female production of King Lear, named Maddie Lee.
These stories are about people, especially a play like Lear. It's not about gender. It's about people and aging. So it's interesting to see a female perspective on it when it's not a play about the battle of the sexes. It doesn't matter if there are men or women playing it. They're just human stories.
Which sounds like she is echoing what Tim just said. And Jennifer, do you come upon things that you feel were written for a man? I mean, are there things where you're like, oh, gee, I wonder how a male would say this? Is there language that you think is particularly male?
Very rarely. Very, very rarely. Yeah, to echo exactly what Mandy and Tim said, we approached the work on Lear from a human perspective. Gender was almost an afterthought. And but occasionally you do get a line that just doesn't make sense. Like in Lear specifically, it's a father referring to his daughters. Well, we have a mother referring to her daughters. So every once and again, we take a little liberty with the text and we'll switch a gender or a pronoun here and there. But that was context-wise, nothing was specifically inherently male or female.
And certainly people have taken a lot of liberties with Shakespeare. My guests are Jennifer Acker, an actress in the Fern Theater's production of King Lear, and Tim McDonough chairs the Theater Studies Program at Emory University. You know, Tim, the women in Shakespeare, although he wrote very well for women, there's great roles for women, they there are lots of things they don't get to do, as you were kind of alluding to earlier. They don't get to lead armies for the most part. They don't get to be in what were traditional male roles of the time. I mean, he's writing in the Renaissance. I wonder what it would be like, and if you've ever considered what it would be like to just switch the genders completely and have the women play the men and vice versa.
Well, this is an interesting thought, and it's a question that comes up whenever you start to play with gender in Shakespeare. If you were going to cast a female Hamlet, should Ophelia then be a male or a woman? And what is it to watch a person go mad, as Ophelia does, if that person is male, and we don't expect the same kind of traditional gender weaknesses and gender sensitivities and gender vulnerabilities in that character. But there are things to be discovered. For example, in the Lear production, which I was happy and privileged to see last evening, that Fern Theatre is being put on, to watch a mother Lear curse her daughter's womb puts a particularly terrible perspective on it. This is one of the things that one might traditionally say, well, you know, that's a male perspective and how insensitive and so forth. But for a woman to curse her daughter's womb, now we are listening attentively to the horror of that particular speech.
We only have about 30 seconds left or so, Jennifer, but I wonder, where do you go from here? Is it possible then, do you think, for all Shakespeare plays to sort of open up the question of casting and gender when it comes to that? It doesn't have to be an all-female production, right?
Oh, I think absolutely. I think with the heritage of it being all male, it is so indicative that it doesn't actually matter who plays what gender. And I think the way Shakespeare should be moving forward is 50% representation of gender equality. And let's take that a step further to race and age and ability conscious casting as well.
Don't go crazy here now. That is Jennifer Acker. She's an actress in the all-female production of King Lear by the Fern Theatre Company in Atlanta. Tim McDonough is chair of the Theatre Studies Program at Emory University. Fern's production of King Lear runs through this weekend. You can get more information about the show at gpbnews.org. Tim and Jennifer, thank you both.
Thank you, Celeste.
Thank you, Celeste.
Only the most special of foods can make a seamless transition from breakfast platter to dinner plate. The biscuit certainly holds that honor here in the South. They come baked, fried, or flaky, almost always crowned with a shiny glaze of melted butter. So imagine our excitement when we discovered there's a region of Georgia dedicated to this particular Southern delicacy, the so-called Biscuit Triangle. It's located north of Atlanta between Marietta and Kennesaw. And our producers, Linda Chen and Taylor Gant, eagerly volunteered to investigate this delicious route.
So Taylor, ready to eat some biscuits?
Absolutely. I mean, we got three or four spots we're going to hit up. Let's see who does it best.
You are on the fastest route. You should reach your destination by 12:33 p.m.
All right, so my first destination, Stylesboro Biscuits. And that's where we're going to meet our biscuit expert, Brad.
Place is adorable.
Isn't that cute? Yeah.
My name is Brad Kaplan. I write for Thirsty South and Creative Loafing here in Atlanta about all things food and drink.
So you've never been here before?
It is my first
time. Okay, well, welcome. We have to give you a welcome bell. And here's the menu.
I was out in Kennesaw, and while I was out here, I knew I had to have some biscuits. And I started deciding where I wanted to go, and I realized, oh my gosh, there's Stylesboro, there's the Red-Eyed Mule, there's Mountain Biscuits, and there's a new one I hadn't heard of called the Ugly Biscuit. And they're all in this little general vicinity, and I think it's kind of just special that you have this collection of biscuit shops that you wouldn't find in the city out here in this one general area.
So you're essentially saying the people who live here are the luckiest folks alive.
If you love biscuits, this is a good place to be.
You guys can help yourself to your coffee.
Great.
Have a seat, and we'll bring it out to you once it's all ready to go.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
So So if I'm recommending the route through the Triangle coming up from Atlanta, I would get off first and go to Red-Eyed Mule. That's kind of the most convenient stop off the highway. From there, Mountain Biscuits is right around the corner, like literally within a one-minute drive.
Oh, that's actually where Taylor is right now.
So I've just got out of my car here at the Mountain parking lot, and there is construction going on me like you wouldn't believe. Got backhoes, bulldozers, digging up a huge pit behind this little petite biscuit shack out here in Marietta. So let's see what's going on inside.
Good morning, ma'am.
I'm doing good. I'm Taylor from Georgia Public Project.
My name's Deborah Ingram, and we've owned this place since 2008. We opened in 2009.
The lovely lady over here told me about like the roll lard into the into the biscuits in the process. Where did that idea come from? Was that just something off the top of your head?
That's just a Southern recipe. It's three ingredients: self-rising flour, buttermilk, and lard. It's actually how you handle it that makes a good biscuit. Yeah. I mean, how you handle the lard and break it up into the flour, and how you handle the dough can totally change the taste of the biscuit.
Do most people use lard in their biscuits, or is that something that's kind of unique?
Most Southern people.
Oh, I just got a text from Taylor. He says Mountain Biscuits are pretty good.
Mountain Biscuits, a lot like Stylesboro. It's this cute old house, you know, on a kind of country road where you walk in and it just feels like the whole neighborhood is there hanging out. Very similar to Stylesboro, in fact, in that the menu, you know, you have your biscuits, you have all your various toppings. A lot of people are picking them up and taking them to go and chatting while they're in line. Again, I think it's a lot about the vibe of the place that makes it so special. And then Stylesboro is straight up the road past Kennesaw Mountain from there. And Stylesboro closes the earliest of all the four that we talked about. So you have to make sure you get to Stylesboro by 11:30. And then you can go to Ugly Biscuit for lunch. Actually, they do a number of things like smoked pork that they're doing, where they serve more interesting kind of like biscuit sandwiches at lunchtime. So it's a perfect end to the biscuit trek up here.
Head west on Stylesboro Road Northwest toward Old Stylesboro Road Northwest. Then turn left onto Edgeboro Drive Northwest.
How are you doing today?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing well. You coming to eat with us?
The Ugly Biscuits, it is more of a sit-down restaurant, and what I immediately saw was that they had Benton's Bacon and Benton's Country Ham on the menu, which, if you're not familiar with Benton's, is one of the most... Oh my gosh, it's one of the most famous bacons in the world because it's intensely smoky. Alan Benton is the maker up in Tennessee, and it's justifiably famous for just being an incredibly intense bacon experience.
It takes him on the ham a minimum of 1 year to cure a ham, where Smithfield's does it in 60 days. It takes him 60 days just to cure bacon. He smokes it twice. He does a cold smoke for 8 hours, lets it sit for 6 hours, and cold smokes it again for 8 hours.
So I saw they had that in the menu, and I had that, oh, I have to have a biscuit with some of the Benton's ham on it. And they had a local sorghum syrup, which if you're an old-time Southern biscuit eater, you've got to love sorghum syrup on your biscuit. And most of the places these days have given up on it. I think it's fallen out of favor, but I still love a good, you know, dollop of sorghum soaking into the biscuit.
My son growing up was a very picky eater. And when you make biscuits and you roll biscuits out, and you have the dough that's left over, and you roll the second ones, those are called ugly biscuits. He always claimed those tasted better than the regular biscuits. Him also being a Leo insisted everybody had to eat ugly biscuits. So my wife came up with a way to make them all look like that so that everybody would do what he wanted. So at that point, we called them the ugly biscuits. He always wanted the ugly biscuits. When we started, it sounded better than Dave's Biscuit Shop. So that's where we came up with the name.
I don't think there's such a thing as a perfect biscuit because I think it's such a personal decision what type of biscuit you like. And there's a wide range of styles that are out there, especially as you go through this, you know, biscuit triangle. You know, these are all like old time pit stops along the road to somewhere from Kennesaw to wherever. They're not in a strip mall. They're not in a mega development. These are old buildings that just have a lot of character. I think it just sets the tone for the type of, you know, food and warmth that they're delivering to their customers. Hey, okay. I think we're good.
Are you happy?
Oh, very happy.
Very, very happy.
Thank you.
Hello?
Hey, Taylor, how'd it go?
Hey, Linda, it's good to hear from you. Yeah, it was absolutely fantastic on my end. I think the Mountain
had the best biscuit I've ever tasted. I absolutely think a nap is in order. I'm going to go home, hit the hay, and I'll see you at work tomorrow.
All right. Take care.
We've already heard from a lot of you about biscuits on Twitter. Jacob Hawkins shouts out Ugly Biscuit in Kennesaw and Buttermilk Kitchen in Buckhead. Whit Whitmire says he's always craving homegrown George's comfy biscuit doused in crystal. So what is that, Whit? Syrup or crystal sugar? Amy1N stepped in to say, y'all all know the best biscuits in ATL are made in somebody's granny's house, not in any restaurant. And we want to hear what you think. Where are the best biscuits? Maybe in your own house. Call us at 404-500-9457. We're on Twitter at OST Talk or post to Facebook. Our show is produced by Sean Powers, Linda Chen, and Taylor Gant. Our interns are Olivia Reingold and Jenna Stafford. Lindsay Foster Thomas is our senior producer. Our engineer is Jacob Bokey, and Tanya Ott is the VP of radio. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Hadley. Have a great day.
The other day, I ate a cold water sandwich and a sun nickel to meat and bun. Do 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 bo. Cow cow, lovin' and I'm lovin' lovin'. Now ride a rickety ticky hubba lubba. How Lord, I wonder what's up a do. Here ride a livin' in a hubba lubba. Now ride a hubbin' in a wonderful. Here ride a fun and a ragga ragga. Pull down a hell tickle lubba hubba. Bend down a wonder what's up a do. Here ride a hubbin' in a gundabba.